They found Esk sitting in the fork of a big apple tree. The boys didn't like the tree much. For one thing, it was so covered in mistletoe that it looked green even in midwinter. Its fruit was small and went from stomach-twisting sourness to wasp-filled rottenness overnight. And although it looked easy enough to climb, it had a habit of breaking twigs and dislodging feet at inconvenient moments. Cern once swore that a branch had twisted just to spill him off. But it tolerated Esk, who used to go and sit in it if she was annoyed or fed up or just wanted to be by herself. And the boys sensed that every brother's right to gently torture his sister ended at the foot of its trunk. So they threw a snowball at her. It missed.
We're going to see old Weatherwax, but you don't have to come. Because you'll just slow us down and probably cry anyway.
Esk looked down at them solemnly. She didn't cry a lot. Never seemed to achieve much.
If you don't want me to come, then I'll come, she said.
This sort of thing passes for logic among siblings.
Oh, we want you to come,
said Gaulter quickly.
Very pleased to hear it,
said Esk, dropping onto the packed snow. They had a basket containing smoked sausages, preserved eggs, and, because their mother was prudent as well as generous, a large jar of peach preserve that no one in the family liked very much. She still made it every year, when the little wild peaches were ripe anyway. The people of Badass had learned to live with the long winter snows, and the roads out of the village were lined with boards to reduce drifting, and more important, stop travellers from straying. If they lived locally, it wouldn't matter too much if they did, because an unsung genius on the village council several generations previously had come up with an idea of carving markers in every 10th tree in the forest around the village, out to a distance of nearly 2 miles. It had taken ages, and recutting markers was always a job for any man with spare time. But in winters, where a blizzard could lose a man within yards of his home, many a life had been saved by the pattern of notches found by probing fingers under the clinging snow. It was snowing again when they left the road and started up the track where, in summer, the witch's house nestled in a riot of raspberry thickets and weird witch growth.
No footprints, said Cern.
Except for foxes, said Gaulter. They say she can turn herself into a fox, or anything, a bird even, anything. That's how she always knows what's going on.
They looked around cautiously. A scruffy crow was indeed watching them from a distant tree stump.
They say there's a whole family over Crack Peep Way that can turn themselves into wolves, said Gaulter,
who wasn't one to leave a promising subject.
Because one night, someone shot a wolf, and next day their auntie was limping with an arrow wound in her leg, and...
I don't think people can turn themselves into animals, said Esk slowly. Oh, yes, Miss Clever.
Granny is quite big. If she turned herself into a fox, what would happen to all the bits that wouldn't fit?
She'd just magic them away, said Cern.
I don't think magic works like that, said Esk. You can't just make things happen. There's a sort of... like a seesaw thing. If you push one end down, the other end goes up. Her voice trailed off. They gave her a look.
I can't see Granny on the seesaw, said Gaulter.
Cern giggled.
No, I mean, every time something happens, something else has to happen too, I think,
said Esk uncertainly, picking her way around a deeper-than-usual snowdrift.
Only in the opposite direction.
That's silly, said Gaulter. Because look, you remember when that fair came last summer, and there was a wizard with it, and he made all those birds and things appear out of nothing? I mean, it just happened. He just said these words and waved his hands, and then it just happened. There weren't any seesaws.
There was a swing, said Cern. And a thing where you had to throw things at things to win things. And you didn't hit anything, Gull.
Nor did you. You said the things were stuck to things so you could knock them off. You said...
Their conversation wandered away like a couple of puppies. Esk listened with half an ear. I know what I mean, she told herself. Magic's easy. You just find the place where everything is balanced and push. Anyone can do it. There's nothing magical about it. All the funny words and waving the hand is just... It's only for... She stopped, surprised at herself. She knew what she meant. The idea was right up there in the front of her mind, but she didn't know how to say it in words, even to herself. It was a horrible feeling to find things in your head and not know how they fitted. It...
Come on, we'll be all day!
She shook her head and hurried after her brothers. The witch's cottage consisted of so many extensions and lean-tos that it was difficult to see what the original building had looked like, or even if there had ever been one. In the summer, it was surrounded by dense beds of what Granny loosely called the herbs, strange plants, hairy or squat or twining, with curious flowers or vivid fruits or unpleasantly bulging pods. Only Granny knew what they were all for, and any wood pigeon hungry enough to attack them generally emerged giggling to itself and bumping into things, or sometimes never emerged at all. Now everything was deep under the snow. A forlorn windsock flapped against its pole. Granny didn't hold with flying, but some of her friends still used broomsticks.
"It looks deserted," said Cern. "No smoke," said Gulter.
"The windows looked like eyes," thought Esk, but kept it to herself.
"It's only Granny's house," she said. "There's nothing wrong."
The cottage radiated emptiness. They could feel it. The windows did look like eyes, black and menacing against the snow. And no one in the Ramtops let their fire go out in winter as a matter of pride. Esk wanted to say, "Let's go home." But she knew that if she did, the boys would run for it. Instead, she said,
"Mother says there's a key on a nail in the privy."
And that was nearly as bad. Even an ordinary unknown privy held minor terrors like wasps' nests, large spiders, mysterious rustling things in the roof, and one very bad winter, a small hibernating bear that caused acute constipation in the family until it was persuaded to bed down in the hay barn. A witch's privy could contain anything.
"I'll go and look, shall I?"
she added.
"If you like,"
said Gulter airily, almost successfully concealing his relief. In fact, when she managed to get the door open against the piled snow, it was neat and clean and contained nothing more sinister than an old almanac, or more precisely, about half an old almanac, carefully hung on a nail. Granny had a philosophical objection to reading, but she'd be the last to say that books, especially books with nice thin pages, didn't have their uses. The key shared a ledge by the door with a chrysalis and a stump of a candle. Esk took it gingerly, trying not to disturb the chrysalis, and hurried back to the boys. There was no use trying the front door. Front doors in Badass were used only by brides and corpses, and Granny had always avoided becoming either. Around the back, the snow was piled in front of the door, and no one had broken the ice on the water butt. The light was starting to pour out of the sky by the time they dug through to the door and managed to persuade the key to turn. Inside, the big kitchen was dark and chilly and smelled only of snow. It was always dark, but they were used to seeing a big fire in the wide chimney and smelling the thick fumes of whatever it was she was boiling up this time, which sometimes gave you a headache or made you see things. They wandered around uncertainly, calling, until Esk decided that they couldn't put off going upstairs any longer. A clonk, the thumb latch on the door to the cramped staircase, sounded a lot louder than it ought to. Granny was on the bed, with her arms tightly folded across her chest. The tiny window had blown open. Fine snow had blown in across the floor and over the bed. Esk stared at the patchwork quilt under the old woman, because there were times when a little detail could expand and fill the whole world. She barely heard Cern start to cry. She remembered her father, strangely enough, making the quilt 2 winters before when the snow was almost as bad and there wasn't much to do in the forge, and how he'd used all kinds of rags that had found their way to Badass from every part of the world, like silk, dilemma leather, water cotton, and Tharga wool, and of course, since he wasn't much good at sewing either, the result was a rather strange, lumpy thing, more like a flat tortoise than a quilt. And her mother had generously decided to give it to Granny last Hog's Watch night. And...
Is she dead?
Asked Gulter, as if Esk was an expert in these things. Esk stared up at Granny Weatherwax. The old woman's face looked thin and grey. Was that how dead people looked? Shouldn't her chest be going up and down? Gulter pulled himself together.
We ought to go and get someone. We ought to go now, because it will be dark in a minute, he said flatly. But Cern will stay here.
His brother looked at him in horror.
What for? He said. Someone has got to stay with dead people, said Gulter. Remember when old Uncle Durkhart died, and Father had to go and sit up with all the candles and things all night? Otherwise, something nasty comes and takes your soul off to somewhere.
He ended lamely.
And then people come back and haunt you.
Cern opened his mouth to start to cry again. Esk said hurriedly,
I'll stay, I don't mind. It's only Granny.
Gulter looked at her in relief.
Light some candles or something, he said. I think that's what you're supposed to do, and then...
There was a scratching from the windowsill. A crow had landed and stood there blinking suspiciously at them. Gulter shouted and threw his hat at it. It flew off with a reproachful caw, and he shut the window.
I've seen it around here before, he said. I think Granny feeds it, fed it.
He corrected himself.
Anyway, we'll be back with people. We'll hardly be any time. Come on, Cern.
They clattered down the stairs. Esk saw them out of the house and bolted the door behind them. The sun was a red ball above the mountains, and there was already a few early stars out. She wandered around the dark kitchen until she found a scrap of dip candle and a tinderbox. After a great deal of effort, she managed to light the candle and stood it on the table. Although it didn't really light the room, it simply peopled the darkness with shadows. Then she found Granny's rocking chair by the cold fireplace and settled down to wait. Time passed. Nothing happened. Then there was a tapping at the window. Esk took up the candle stub and peered through the thick, round panes. A beady yellow eye blinked back at her. The candle guttered and went out. She stood stock still, hardly breathing. The tapping started again, and then stopped. There was a short silence. Then the door latch rattled. Something nasty comes, the boys had said. She felt her way back across the room until she nearly tripped over the rocking chair and dragged it back and wedged it as best she could in front of the front door. The latch gave a final clonk and went silent. Esk waited, listening until the silence roared in her ears. Then something started to bang against the little window in the scullery, softly but insistently. After a while it stopped. A moment later it started again in the bedroom above her. A faint scrabbling noise, a claw kind of noise. Esk felt that bravery was called for, but on a night like this, bravery lasted only as long as a candle stayed alight. She felt her way back across the dark kitchen, eyes tightly shut, until she reached the door. There was a thump from the fireplace as a big lump of soot fell down, and when she heard the desperate scratchings coming from the chimney, she slipped the bolts, threw open the door, and darted out into the night. The cold struck like a knife. Frost had put a crust on the snow, She didn't care where she was going, but quiet terror gave her a burning determination to get there as fast as she could. Inside the cottage, the crow landed heavily in the fireplace, surrounded by soot and muttering irritably to itself. It hopped into the shadows, and a moment later there was a bang on the latch of the stairway door and the sound of fluttering on the stairs. Esk reached up as high as she could and felt around the tree for the marker. This time she was lucky, but the pattern of dots and grooves told her that she was over a mile from the village and had been running in the wrong direction. There was a cheese-rind moon and a sprinkling of stars, small and bright and pitiless. The forest around her was a pattern of black shadows and pale snow, and she was aware not all the shadows were standing still. Everyone knew there were wolves in the mountains, because on some nights their howls echoed down from the high tops, but they seldom came near the village. The modern wolves were the offsprings of ancestors that had survived because they had learned that human meat had sharp edges. But the weather was hard, and this pack was hungry enough to forget all about natural selection. Esk remembered what all the children were told. Climb up a tree, light a fire, when all else fails, find a stick and at least hurt them. Never try to outrun them. The tree behind her was a beech, smooth and unclimbable. Esk watched a long shadow detach itself from a pool of darkness in front of her and move a little closer. She knelt down, tired, frightened, unable to think, and scrabbled under the burning cold snow for a stick. Granny Weatherwax opened her eyes and stared at the ceiling, which was cracked and bulged like a tent. She concentrated on remembering that she had arms, not wings, and didn't need to hop. It was always wise to lie down for a bit after a borrow, to let one's mind get used to one's body, but she knew she didn't have the time.
"Drat the child,"
she muttered, and tried to fly onto the bed rail. The crow, who had been through all this dozens of times before, and who considered, insofar as birds can consider anything, which is a very short distance indeed, that a steady diet of bacon rinds and choice kitchen scraps and a warm roost for the night was well worth the occasional inconvenience of letting Granny share its head, watched her with mild interest. Granny found her boots and thumped down the stairs, sternly resisting the urge to glide. The door was wide open, and there was already a drift of fine snow on the floor.
"Oh, bugger," she said.
She wondered if it was worth trying to find Esk's mind, but human minds were never so sharp and clear as animal minds, and anyway, the overmind of the forest itself made impromptu searching as hard as listening for a waterfall in a thunderstorm. But even without looking, she could feel the pack mind of the wolves, a sharp, rank feeling that filled the mouth with the taste of blood. She could just make out the small footprints in the crust, half filled with fresh snow. Cursing and muttering, Granny Weatherwax pulled her shawl around her and set out. The white cat awoke from its private ledge in the forge when it heard the sounds coming from the darkest corner. Smith had carefully shut the big doors behind him when he went off, with the nearly hysterical boys, and the cat watched with interest as a thin shadow prodded at the lock and tested the hinges. The doors were oak, hardened by heat and time, but that didn't prevent them being blown right across the street. Smith heard a sound in the sky as he hurried along the track. So did Granny. It was a determined, whirring sound like a flight of geese, and the snow clouds boiled and twisted as it passed. The wolves heard it too, as it spun low over the treetops and hurtled down into the clearing. But they heard it far too late. Granny Weatherwax didn't have to follow the footprints now. She aimed herself for the distant flashes of weird light. the strange swishing and thumping, and the howls of pain and terror. A couple of wolves bolted past her with ears flattened in grim determination to have it away on their paws no matter what stood in their way. There was the crackle of breaking branches. Something big and heavy landed in a fir tree by Granny and crashed, whimpering, into the snow. Another wolf passed her in flat trajectory about head height and bounced off a tree trunk. There was silence. Granny pushed her way between the snow-covered branches. She could see that the snow was flattened in a white circle. A few wolves lay at its edges, either dead or wisely deciding to make no move. The staff stood upright in the snow, and Granny got the feeling it was turning to face her as she walked carefully past it. There was also a small heap in the centre of the circle, curled tightly up inside itself. Granny knelt down with some effort and reached out gently. The staff moved. It was little more than a tremble, but her hand stopped just before it touched Esk's shoulder. Granny glared up at the wooden carvings and dared it to move again. The air thickened. Then the staff seemed to back away while not moving, while at the same time something quite indefinable made it absolutely clear to the old witch that as far as the staff was concerned, this wasn't a defeat. It was merely a tactical consideration, and it wouldn't like her to think she had won in any way, because she hadn't. Esk gave a shudder. Granny patted her vaguely.
"It's me, little one. It's only old Granny."
The hump didn't uncurl. Granny bit her lip. She was never quite certain about children, thinking of them, when she thought about them at all, as coming somewhere between animals and people. She understood babies. You put milk in one end and kept the other end as clean as possible. Adults were even easier, because they did the feeding and cleaning themselves, but in between was a world of experience she had never really inquired about. As far as she was aware, you just tried to stop them catching anything fatal and hoped that it would all turn out all right. Granny, in fact, was at a loss, but she knew she had to do something.
"Did a nasty wolf eat frightened us, then?"
she hazarded. For quite the wrong reasons, this seemed to work. From the depths of the ball, a muffled voice said,
"I am 8, you know." "People who are 8 don't curl up in the middle of the snow," said Granny,
feeling her way through the intricacies of adult-child conversation. The ball didn't answer.
"I've probably got some milk and biscuits at home,"
Granny ventured. There was no perceptible effect.
"Escarina Smith, if you don't behave this minute, I will give you such a smack."
Esk poked her head out cautiously.
"There's no need to be like that," she said.
When Smith reached the cottage, Granny had just arrived, leading Esk by the hand. The boys peered around from behind him.
Said
Smith, not quite aware of how to begin a conversation with someone who was supposed to be dead.
"They, told me you were ill."
He turned and glared at his sons.
"I was just having a rest, and I must have dozed off. I sleep's very sound."
"Yes," said Smith uncertainly. "Well, all's well, then. What's up with Esk?"
"She took a bit of a fright," said Granny, squeezing the girl's hand. "Shadows and what not. She needs a good warm. I was going to put her in my bed. She's a bit mazed, if that's all right with you."
Smith wasn't absolutely sure that it was all right with him, but he was quite sure that his wife, like every other woman in the village, held Granny Weatherwax in solemn regard, even in awe, and that if he started to object, he would rapidly get out of his depth.
"Fine, fine," he said, "if it's no trouble. I'll send along for her in the morning, shall I?"
"That's right," said Granny.
I'd invite you in, but there's me without a fire.
No, no, that's all right, said Smith hurriedly. I've got my supper waiting. Drying up, he added, looking down at Gaulter,
who opened his mouth to say something, and wisely thought better of it. When they had gone, with the sound of the two boys' protests ringing out among the trees, Granny opened the door, pushed Esk inside, and bolted it behind them. She took a couple of candles from her store above the dresser and lit them. Then she pulled some old but serviceable wool blankets, still smelling of anti-moth herbs, from an old chest, wrapped Esk in them, and sat her in the rocking chair. She got down on her knees to an accompaniment of clicks and grunts, and started to lay the fire. It was a complicated business, involving dry fungus punk wood shavings, bits of split twig, and much puffing and swearing. Esk said,
"You don't have to do it like that, Granny."
Granny stiffened and looked at the fire back. It was a rather nice one Smith had cast for her years ago, with an owl and bat motif. Currently, though, she wasn't interested in the design.
"Oh, yes,"
she said, her voice dead level.
"You know of a better way, do you?"
"You could magic it alight."
Granny paid great attention to arranging bits of twig on the reluctant flames.
"How would I do that?"
she said, apparently addressing her remarks to the fireback.
Said Esk. I can't remember, but you must know anyway, don't you? Everyone knows you can do magic."
"There's magic," said Granny. "And then again, there's magic. The important thing, my girl, is to know what magic is for and what it isn't for. And you can take it from me, it was never intended for lighting fires. You can be absolutely certain of that. If the Creator had meant us to use magic for lighting fires, he wouldn't have given us, matches."
"But could you light a fire with magic?" said Esk,
as Granny slung an ancient black kettle on its hook.
"I mean, if you wanted to, if it was allowed."
"Maybe,"
said Granny, who couldn't. Fire had no mind. It wasn't alive. And they were two of the three reasons.
"You could light it much better."
"If a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly,"
said Granny, fleeing into aphorisms, the last refuge of an adult under siege.
"Yes, but me no buts."
Granny rummaged in a dark wooden box on the dresser. She prided herself on her unrivaled knowledge of the properties of Ramtop's herbage. No one knew better than she the many uses of earwort, maiden's wish, and love lies oozing. But there were times when she had to resort to her small stock of jealously traded and carefully hoarded medicines from fawn parts, which, as far as she was concerned, was anywhere further than a day's journey, to achieve the desired effect. She shredded some dry red leaves into a mug, topped it up with honey and hot water from the kettle, and pushed it into Esk's hands. Then she put a large round stone under the grate. Later on, wrapped in a scrap of blanket, it will make a bed warmer. And with a stern injunction to the girl not to stir from the chair, went out into the scullery. Esk drummed her heels on the chair legs and sipped the drink. It had a strange, peppery taste. She wondered what it was. She'd tasted Granny's brews before, of course, with a greater or lesser amount of honey in them, depending on whether she thought she were making too much of a fuss. And Esk knew that she was famous throughout the mountains for special potions, for illnesses that her mother, and some young women too, once in a while, just hinted at with raised eyebrows and lowered voices. When Granny came back, she was asleep. She didn't remember being put to bed, or Granny bolting the windows.